From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a Sikh temple shooting. Truth and lies on the campaign trail, wheels on Mars, and a gold medal for U.S. women's soccer. Harry Reid made waves after he accused Mitt Romney, without evidence, of not paying taxes for years. On ABC's This Week, Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus went for the L word, liar.
As far as Harry Reid is concerned, listen, I know you might want to go down that road. I'm not going to respond to a dirty liar.
On Monday, a lone shooter killed six Sikh worshipers at a temple in Wisconsin. Here's a temple member.
We may never understand truly what had happened, why it happened, but we know that what will carry us through is our faith.
And after traveling more than 8 months and 352 million miles, NASA's new rover, Curiosity, landed safely on Mars. Ground control went nuts.
Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Laura Meckler of the Wall Street Journal. On Point news analyst Jack Beatty is with us. You can join the conversation. Where's the truth in this presidential campaign? Are you watching the Olympics, the mass murders, Mars? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're hoping to get over to Olympics country with Financial Times reporter Gideon Rockman from the Financial Times in London in a few minutes. But with us first from Washington, Laura Meckler, White House correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, fresh off the campaign trail in Colorado. Laura Meckler, thank you so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
From Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty is here. Hello, Jack.
Tom, hello, Laura.
Hey, and from London, yes, we've got Gideon. Gideon Rockman is with us, chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times. Gideon, great to have you with us. Nice show you're putting on over there.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I was there last night.
Oh, good. We'll talk about it. It's great to have you here. Listen, we've got to talk about, truth and dare, truth and lies here for a second. It's all over the campaign trail this week. It started at the end of last week when Harry Reid, on the floor of the Senate, said, you know, people have told him that Mitt Romney hadn't paid taxes maybe for a decade, and things just blew up after that. Now, the White House, here's a little bit from Jay Carney. He's the White House spokesman at a White House briefing. NBC political director Chuck Todd pushed him on this, and he said, well, you know, if Mitt Romney would just release those taxes, we'd know.
It's a tradition that, as Governor Romney, Governor George Romney, said back in the 1968 cycle, is important to get a sense of...
So you're comfortable with what Harry Reid's doing?
I'm not making a judgment on it. I'm simply saying that this whole thing could be resolved in a minute.
The White House spokesman not making a judgment on Harry Reid's right out there statement, but a whole lot of other people have, Laura Meckler. Describe the response to this for us.
Well, it's been pretty amazing. I mean, Harry Reid said this. He said someone told him. He doesn't have any evidence of it. Republicans have gone, you know, nuts. They're just, you know, apoplectic about this. Mitt Romney himself responded and said, you know, put up or shut up. You know, if you have somebody, say it. And Democrats are sort of like, well, that's Harry Reid. We can't stop him. But, you know, they're happy to have him continue to sort of keep this issue in the news. So I think the most remarkable thing about the whole thing is that what are we talking about today? We're talking about Mitt Romney's taxes.
Yeah.
And about how he hasn't released more than, well, he's really released one full year, and he says he'll release a second. So, you know, from that point of view, I think it's been spectacularly successful on Senator Reid's part in keeping the conversation to some extent, you know, trained on this matter. You know, whether it's a legitimate point he's making, whether you can come out and say, I have some anonymous person who says he hasn't paid any taxes, I mean, it's you know, nobody would take a charge like that seriously, you know, in any setting. You know, a journalist wouldn't just accept that.
Yeah.
You know, but it's, from a political point of view, it is having its effect.
Jack Beatty, is this Joe McCarthy come back to life in the shoes of Harry Reid on the floor of the U.S. Senate? Or is this fair enough campaign season showmanship with Harry Reid saying, look, all I'm saying is he should show us his tax returns?
Oh, it's McCarthy 2.0. I mean, there's just no question. It's the most outrageous thing I've heard in years. And to see Jay Carney saying, well, Romney really ought to release his tax returns. And to see Debbie Wasserman Schultz saying, well, I mean.
But he's not asking to admit he's a Communist Party member. He's asking
to be
open about his taxes, and he's a rich guy.
Sure. But that's not the way to do it. There's no possible. I mean, that's exactly what McCarthy was saying. I have a list here of 200
names. In my satchel.
He never showed the list, right. And it changed. It was 80. It was 100. It's the same kind of thing, and we're in this pollution with this kind of thing, and it's poisoning these campaigns. You know, finally, these campaigns are moral tests, right? This is the only chance we have to see these people before they're elected. How do they behave? Do they tell the truth? Do they have a sense of honor, an inner check that'll stop them from going over the line, from lying about the other candidate? And thus far, on the basis of this campaign, neither candidate seems to have a very strong sense of honor.
Jack, you sound like Mitt Romney's camp. They're pulling out the dishonor word. On the other side of the line here, there was a new Romney ad this weekend. Lots of comments from Mitt Romney going after Barack Obama on the welfare front. This was a campaign ad released, claiming that Barack Obama gutted the 1996 Bill Clinton's welfare reform law, the ad says, by eliminating the work requirement. Here's that ad. Let's listen.
In 1996, President Clinton and a bipartisan Congress helped end welfare as we know it by requiring work for welfare. But on July 12th, President Obama quietly announced a plan to gut welfare reform by dropping work requirements. Under Obama's plan, you wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check. And welfare to work goes back to being plain old welfare. Mitt Romney will restore the work requirement because it works.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Okay, and here's Jay Carney once again.
This advertisement is categorically false, and it is blatantly dishonest.
Okay, Gideon Rockman in London, forgive us. We're having a little American powwow here on truth and consequences. But Laura, let me come to you on this one. I mean, I'm reading Bill Clinton here, and they cite Clinton in the ad. But Bill Clinton came out, of course, Democrat, of course, for Barack Obama. But he said Romney released an ad today alleging that the Obama administration had weakened the work requirements. Bill Clinton, who led the charge in the first place, said that is not true. Where's truth lie here, Laura?
Well, the truth is there really isn't a lot of evidence to support the Romney claim. What the president did, what the Obama administration did, was say that states could apply for waivers. And if they show that they have a more effective way to move people from welfare to work, then they can have more flexibility in designing their program.
Like what? Like education or training or something? Or I mean, what?
Yeah, there isn't a lot of specifics yet exactly mm-hmm. what they're saying, but they're trying to give states the ability to sort of innovate is the idea. So the irony of the whole thing is that when he was governor of Massachusetts, Governor Romney requested this kind of flexibility and wanted these sorts of waivers. And in fact, all governors generally do want flexibility like this, both Republican and Democrat. So yes, there are fewer strings from Washington. There will be if you design your own program and if you manage to get a waiver and you're able to prove that you think it will be more effective, then you have fewer strings from Washington telling you exactly how you have to design it. So in that sense, it is, quote, weaker. But there's a long history of waivers in this program, in the welfare program, and it's not out of bounds with sort of how the program has been conceived. I think that the attacks are probably over the line in this one.
But Mitt Romney was not backing off an inch. Here he was in Des Moines on Wednesday.
With a very careful executive action, he removed the requirement of work from welfare. It is wrong to make any change that would make America more of a nation of government dependency. We must restore, and I will restore, work into welfare.
Okay, Jack, is Joe McCarthy marching again here, or is this fair game?
I think it's just reckless mendacity. I mean, there's just no question about it. You quoted Bill Clinton. The other day, NPR had a report where they quoted a Republican.
Ron Haskins, I think.
Yeah, who was involved in the
plausible scenario in
absolutely.
Which it constitutes a serious attack on welfare reform.
Yes, that's from a Republican. So, and then Mitt Romney said, I approve this message. How can he? If it's not true, why? What does that say about him? What would the same thing say about Obama?
Okay, we have to do one more. We played the Romney ad. Here's the Obama ad that got so much kind of saying Mitt Romney killed this guy's wife. And this goes all, I mean, I'm boiling it way too far down. But that was the objection that was made to it. This was not the Obama campaign, but a super PAC, lots of those at work here, with an advertisement came out on Tuesday, features former Kansas City steelworker Joe Soptic talking about the death of his wife after Romney's company, the company he founded anyway, Bain Capital, took over the plant where he worked. This ad has brought so much attention because of the kind of link here that's made here between the Bain takeover and his wife's death. Here's the full ad.
I don't think Mitt Romney understands what he's done to people's lives by closing the plant. I don't think he realizes that people's lives completely changed. When Mitt Romney and Bain closed the plant, I lost my health care. And my family lost their health care. And A short time after that, my wife became ill. I don't know how long she was sick. And I think maybe she didn't say anything because she knew that we couldn't afford the insurance. And then one day she became ill, and I took her up to the Jackson County Hospital and admitted her for pneumonia, and that's when they found the cancer. And by then it was stage four. There was nothing they could do for her. And she passed away in 22 days. I do not think Mitt Romney realizes what he's done to anyone. And furthermore, I do not think Mitt Romney is concerned.
Priorities USA Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Lord Meckler, strip it down, strip out the music. It's Mitt Romney killed my wife. Fair or a crazy stretch?
I think it is a crazy stretch. I mean, there are so many steps that happened from point A to point Z, point A being when he lost his job at the plant, to point Z when his wife died, that to blame that on Mitt Romney is a super stretch. And this ad has, you know, put the Obama campaign in a real, real pickle, because they have, you know, their allies at Priorities USA have said they're going to air this. By the way, this ad has not even aired yet, so we'll see if it ends up on the air at all.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, truth and campaigning, a temple shooting, wheels on Mars, U.S. women's soccer triumphs over Japan at the London Olympics. Gideon Rackman is with us from London, chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times. The Wall Street Journal's White House correspondent, Laura Meckler, joins us today. Great to have her with us from Washington, just off the campaign trail in Colorado. Jack Beatty's here. Let's hear right from our listeners, Oscar in Sandown, New Hampshire. Oscar, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see?
Well, I saw the rich guy from New York there who was running for
Mr.
president.
Trump, perhaps. Donald Trump, maybe.
Yes, Mr. Trump, yes. Thank you very much. I believe he said just not maybe 2-3 months ago that he heard people say that Mr. Obama doesn't have a birth certificate. So I don't understand where Jack is saying that we haven't had any kind of lies like that going on, and now Mr. Harry Reid, I believe, is just turning the tables and saying that he heard that he's not paying any taxes.
Well, yeah, we all can hear a lot of things. We'll think about the Trump factor there, Oscar. Tom in Columbia, South Carolina. Tom, you're on.
Hello, Tom. I kind of would echo the same thing, a little bit disagreeing with Jack in the sense of maybe Harry Reid's heavy-handed, but the subject is correct. CNN just came out with a poll. It says 67% of independents want more tax returns. And the way to sum it up is a great paraphrase of Howard Baker's Watergate line. As to Romney's tax returns, what did he owe and when did he owe it? And I think that's what America wants to know.
So get those tax returns out there. And one more, Charlie's calling. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom and Gus.
Hi.
I think Harry Reid's comment is basically saying that Obama's presidency is incompetent, him being in charge of the executive branch. If Romney's not paying taxes, that's IRS's job to take care of. And if they're not going after Romney, that's Obama's job.
So what if they weren't paid, the Obama IRS should have known about it. And okay, we got it, Charlie. Hey, Gideon, you're watching all this from London. I mean, you guys have your own votes, your own campaigns. You must have your own issues of truth and stretching the truth. How does this look to you? And in particular, Gideon, what about British politicians? Do they put all their tax returns out on the table for the electorate to look at?
Well, increasingly, the trend is towards more and more openness. We had a scandal here about expenses, and where a lot of things that were regarded as okay for many years, parliamentarians claiming slightly odd things on expenses, mm-hmm, partly because they get low salaries, are suddenly totally unacceptable. And so there is this drive for more openness. And I must say, from across the channel, across the Atlantic, mm-hmm, it doesn't seem to me that what Harry Reid did was so outrageous. I mean, it's very rough politics, but it's pretty clear what he's doing. He's ratcheting up the pressure on Mitt Romney, and Romney can release tax returns and end the story if there isn't something to hide. It's stretching the point, but it seems to me the kind of politics that people might well play here, because if it looks like somebody's hiding something, of course you put the pressure on.
I mean, Laura, in a way, I almost read Harry Reid as facetious, you know. I mean, like he was saying, well, you know, there's an alligator in his tax returns, or, you know, they're pink and blue and gold. And
I don't think so. He was saying, I have talked to somebody who knows that he did not pay taxes. Now, he wasn't saying he broke the
somebody
law.
Who told him, told I thought. Him.
And an aide to Reid has offered a few more details, saying, well, this was somebody who was a business associate of Mr. Romney's. And so he's saying that he has a secret source that is telling him this. Now, he's not, I don't believe, alleging that he broke the law in not paying taxes. He's saying that he was legally able to reduce his tax bill
to zero.
Mm-hmm. That's what the allegation is. Now, to be clear, the Romney campaign has said there is no year in which he paid no taxes. So they have specifically denied that. So he is making the allegation. I think that there are two separate issues here, and they're being conflated into one. I mean, one is sort of a legitimate debate over whether Governor Romney has an obligation to provide more information about his personal finances. And then there's a second thing that says, well, okay, he's refusing to. He said outright, I will not do it. This is all I'm doing. And he said the reason. He says, if I do more, it will just provide fodder for Democratic attacks. Well,
he can say whatever he wants, but the fact is the taxes still aren't out there. I mean, Jack, is anything fair here, any crowbar fair to use to try to get those taxes out there? I mean, he can say it'll just be grounds for more tax, but if you're a voter and you kind of want to know, here's a very wealthy man, he's got all kinds of interests, it seems kind of like fair to know something about more than a year about those finances.
Yes, and when Bill Kristol and other Republicans say, get those things out there, let's have it, that's fine. But when you have Reid making up this, I mean, saying with this farrago, this amazing story on the Senate floor, and then, of course, what do? Gideon was just doing it. I'm not criticizing you, Gideon, but we all do it. Journalists immediately say, well, look how Romney responded to this attack. Well, Todd Gitlin has a wonderful phrase for this. He says when journalists do that, they're inviting voters to be the cognoscenti of their own bamboozlement.
Well, but I mean, maybe you've got a maybe more colorful style there in the UK, Gideon. All kinds of things get said that sound very flamboyant to our American ears in politics.
Yeah, well, there was an incident actually where our in the recent London mayoral election, and Boris Johnson appears to have become a kind of global figure, but that he was accused on
with the Andy Warhol mop top.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was accused on a radio talk show of tax evasion or tax avoidance. Mm-hmm. And he then had an incredible row, which wasn't actually on air, but was witnessed by various people, a four-letter row with his candidate, his rival, in the lift. And
this
became a big thing. But actually, people rather liked Johnson for it because they felt that his kind of outrage at least showed that he probably was telling the truth when he denied it, because he was so upset. But sure, people fling around all sorts of tax allegations here.
So let it rip. Stephanie in Brookline, Massachusetts. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hi. I just had a comment about the advertisement, the Romney killed my wife advertisement.
Okay. I mean, I am boiling it down, but okay.
Yeah. I just wanted to say I am an Obama supporter, but I do agree that went too far. I think if they had just changed the last two lines and said something more along the lines of with the Obamacare Act, this wouldn't have happened, then I think it would have changed the entire message, would have been a little bit more positive, and definitely wouldn't have had the same negative connotations and the same problems with the media.
Yeah, we take it. Like, how far is fair to go to make the point? The Obama campaign has come out and said, well, we're trying to make the point that when people's jobs are so unstable and, you know, you got big investment firms pushing people every which way, bad stuff happens on healthcare. Jenny in Charlottesville, Virginia. Jenny, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my comment. Mm-hmm. It's a brief comment, according to what you all just said about the campaign ads, and that is that you mentioned that Romney said he approved of his ad, whereas you said Obama's ad had not, you didn't mention whether it was approved by him or not, but that a PAC had financed it and it had not even been aired. And I think there's a huge difference here that ought to be made.
You think Obama's hands are cleaner? On the other hand, Obama people have come out and refused to walk away from that ad. This, you know.
No, I agree with the last caller.
Yeah.
I agree with her that it was over the line. And I also agree with some of the other callers that if the taxes were just made transparent, then this would not be an issue at all. And I'm sad that politics has degenerated to this level when there are so many important issues that need to be discussed.
Yeah, you and a lot of others. We'll come right to that. One more on this. Genre in Northampton. You're on the air, Genre.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The reason I was calling is because every time I listen to like News of the Week or something rounding up this week, I'm hearing a lot about this, the commercial that everybody's been talking about, mm-hmm. and there's always a connection between the commercial and the Obama campaign, and it's kind of upsetting when you hear about these Super PAC commercials where they're not connected to the either campaign at all, being lumped in with the telling the truth on the campaign trail. And I'd like to
You want them to have plausible deniability because they're supposed to be uncoordinated. So if the PAC that supports the president or the Super PAC that supports Romney says something outrageous, it doesn't redound to their credibility?
No, I would like... Well, what I would like is for the PACs to say that they are not connected at all with the either campaign, and then the campaign could respond to that. But I think that there should be more of a notice in the media saying this is from a Super PAC that's not. It hasn't been paid for by the Obama campaign.
We get it, but I mean, they're so mixed up together. Listen, right, here's Robert Gibbs. This is the senior Obama campaign advisor. This is Wednesday on MSNBC's Morning Joe. And you can see, say, it's not an entity that we control. Here he is.
This is an ad by an entity that's not controlled by the campaign. I certainly don't know the specifics of this man's case. I do think there is a lot of concern in the country about what happens when people lose their jobs. We know that when they lose their jobs, because most of where people get their health care provided for is in their job, they tend to also lose their health care.
So he makes his big point, but Laura, it's like, I don't know if it's true or false that Romney killed his wife.
You know, that was their line. Several Obama campaign officials said the same thing. We don't know what this guy's story is. And it turns out that they actually had featured the same guy in their own ad and on an own conference call earlier this year with reporters. So they do know his story. And they had to backtrack on that. So it's a very, very slippery slope for the situation the Obama campaign's in. And a lot of people wonder why they don't just come out and say, you know what, this ad went too far. They haven't been willing to do that.
Quite. And I think Stephanie made the capital point. If they had said this wouldn't happen under Obamacare, and you know what? The Romney people, Andrea Saul, his spokeswoman yesterday, said this wouldn't have happened under Romneycare. And it set Rush Limbaugh and the Republicans, you know, the conservatives went crazy over that. How dare you say anything good about Romneycare? I mean, you know, Gideon may find it hard to believe, given the national health in Britain, which I think is a great institution.
Which was so splendidly celebrated, whatever you think of it, on opening night at the Olympics. Holy cow, message to America.
Bouncing nurses. but, you know, the Harvard Medical School, in 2009 had a study estimating, that about 45,000 people a year die in the United States for lack of health insurance. I mean, that's the moral center of this thing.
Hey, let's go to what Mitt Romney is saying, though, and his critique. I mean, the Democrats have theirs around health care and more, but he's saying, say what you want, the economy is not working. Here he was on Wednesday in Des Moines. It's just not working, folks.
It's tough to be middle class in America today. And a lot of folks that are in the middle class have now found themselves falling into poverty, having to go on food stamps. This is very different than the kind of record that occurred under Ronald Reagan. And the president's policies have simply failed the American people in terms of getting people back to work with rising incomes.
Look, the policies have failed, says Romney in Iowa. Now, in Colorado, where Laura was traveling with the president, you know, he said, come on, I need you. I need you out there making phone calls. And if you still believe in me, if you stand with me, knock on some doors, we'll win Colorado. And then he said this.
If we win Colorado, we will win this election. We will finish what we started. And we'll remind the world why America's the greatest nation on earth.
Okay, let's get down to it. Jack, Mitt Romney says, just look around, folks. It's not working. That's his big message on the economy, which is the heart of his campaign. Obama on the other side saying, we will finish what we started. And you've got some people saying, well, what exactly have you started?
Yeah, what would that be exactly? Yes. And there isn't anybody who doubts for a minute but that a second Obama term is going to be massively on the defense against the Republican onslaught in the House and maybe the Senate, and very little is going to get done in terms of advancing any sort of agenda. You know, on these polls, two-thirds now say the country is going in the wrong direction. That's two-thirds. On the other hand, just in the last day, Obama is up 9 points in a Fox poll, 6 points in another poll. Why? Because Romney's favorables are sinking. He's gone down 6 points just in the last month. Why? Because these negative ads are so effective.
Gideon, how's it look to you, this campaign from across the pond? You're seeing our historic President Obama, by his very election, up against our big, successful businessman, Mitt Romney, in a time of terrible economic distress. How's it look to you?
Well, I mean, I think there are many things to say. I mean, you know, it's certainly the case that if Obama were running against Romney in Europe, he would win very easily. He's a charismatic figure, somebody who's very respected here, and we don't have to live with the American economy. We have our own economic problems, which are actually even worse.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
But I think that, you know, as a political analyst, it is very striking that I think no president has been re-elected with unemployment this high since Roosevelt, is the statistic we keep hearing. So Obama's attempting to do something very difficult. It also seems to be the case that once again we have a very negative campaign. I mean, it's always been, it seems to me, every American presidential election campaign people say this is the worst it's ever been.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether it is getting worse or we've just got short memories, but it's clear that negative campaigning does work. But a final thought, I mean, on those Romney ads, whatever the precise truth of them, and it does, you know, it's a bit of a stretch, as others were saying, I think there is a bigger issue at stake, which is perhaps what makes them effective, which is this whole question of the gap between the fortunes of the super rich, such as Mitt Romney, and those that Romney himself was referring to, the middle class and the working class, whose real incomes have been stagnant for the last 30 years or so. And which a problem that was perhaps masked, you know, when the economy was doing well, when there was easy credit, when house prices were going up. But since the Great Recession, I think that there's been much more focus on income inequality and on a kind of backlash against the rich, which you're seeing in America, but you're also seeing in Europe to some extent, so that we have a conservative government here in Britain, which might instinctively in the past have defended bankers' pay, defended finance, which is a very important industry in Britain, but which actually isn't doing so and is taking an increasingly moral tone against them. In France, they've just put the top tax rate up to 75%.
Is that a done deal? Has it happened? It's done?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it's going through. I don't think there's any question. Okay. You know, the socialists control the National 75% Assembly.
75% on that was what incomes over €1 million. What is that? $1.254 million.
Yeah. And in fact, if some French friends say that if you include all the other taxes, social security taxes, special wealth tax, some people could be fortunate enough to be paying over 100%.
How's that going over with over 100% crowd?
Well, you know, there's a big question. Will they all come to London and Cameron or to Geneva?
Flee France.
Yeah. As a long tradition of that, of course, there was in the French Revolution, a lot of French people ended up in London. So, but Cameron is now rather ruffled the feathers of President Hollande, our own Prime Minister, by saying he would lay out a red carpet for rich French and entrepreneurial people who wanted to come to London. And there is a question about, you know, can you raise taxes that high, even if it's popular, without sparking capital flight and the flight of people?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, at the Olympics in London, the world watched as the first Saudi woman ever, Sara Attar, ran the women's 800 meters. She finished last, way back. NBC made the call. But listen to the crowd's support as this first woman from Saudi Arabia ran head covered into history.
And here is Saudi Arabian athlete Sara Attar making a little bit of history by running in the Olympic Games.
Back on Earth, scientists now say that the month of July was the hottest month ever for the lower 48 since record-keeping began in 1895, and we sweltered.
In July alone, more than 2 million acres burned nationwide. and the heat impacts lakes and rivers too. Throughout the Midwest, inland lakes with 80-degree-plus temperatures are causing massive fish kills.
Not a pretty picture. And composer for stage and screen Marvin Hamlisch died Monday in Los Angeles at 68. The Sting, The Way We Were, and his signature song, One, from the Broadway hit, A Chorus Line. We're looking at the week in the news with Laura Meckler, White House correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, Gideon Rachman, chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times, joining us today from London, and Jack Beatty. After that bouncy music, I hate even to turn to it, but we have to. Laura, you were just in Colorado, where we had the cinema, Batman, mass murder. Now here we are in Wisconsin, Oak Creek, with the Temple of Sikhs and the gunman there. I mean, how do you look at what's going on here, Laura? Here's this one big shooting. Here's another big shooting. Meanwhile, we've got the Gabby Gifford guy on trial in Arizona. It's all over the American news.
It is, and it's obviously very shaking when you keep hearing of these tragedies. I guess the way I look at it, I tend to look at things through a political lens, and spend a lot of my time covering the White House, so I think about it, how they're responding. So the interesting thing to me is that President Obama has, after each one of these tragedies, talked about the need to address these issues and address gun violence, but we really have seen almost nothing out of the White House to actually do that.
Just not there. Here, we do have the sound just from this morning from Wisconsin. This is in Oak Creek High School in Wisconsin. Sound of chanting and drums, hundreds of mourners filing into the high school there for memorial service to honor those killed in the Sikh temple shooting. Let's just listen for a minute. Memorial service today, this morning, in Wisconsin for the dead Tavish in Colchester, Vermont. Tavish, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question relates to a topic that you had earlier this week when talking about kind of right-wing supremacy groups. A few years back, Representative Peter King from New York held two hearings on domestic Islamic terrorism, and he had been told repeatedly, especially by the Southern Poverty Law Center, as well as other sources, that the rise should not be kind of focused on domestic Islamic terrorism, given that that was a much more minor threat as opposed to these right-wing militias, as well as the killing of George Tiller and the attempted bombing on Martin Luther King Day parade. And I just was hoping that your guests could further talk about why we refuse to address these issues, especially since we have so much evidence in the way of these white power groups as well as right-wing groups, and yet we continue to focus on Muslims. And this has been reinforced especially by Michelle Bachmann's absolutely insane letter claiming that the Muslim Brotherhood had somehow infiltrated the State Department.
Yeah,
curious
yeah.
Why people continue to beat up.
Tavish, we've got to, Tavish, this issue of focus and where it goes. I mean, Jack, look across this. We've seen the murders. I mean, there's the Arizona one. That's a while back now, but trial this week, and he's going to prison. Colorado in the cinema, Wisconsin, but at the same time, there's also the trial going on, or the military's dealing with the Texas shooting at Fort Hood. That was the one inspired, we're told, through conversations with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But our caller says, look, let's pay attention to some of this white supremacist right-wing stuff, too, here. What a picture, Jack.
Oh, my gosh. Philip Roth, in one of his novels, speaks of the indigenous American berserk. And, my God, there are those berserkers out there who just seem, you know, I mean, the Sikh, for example, over 1,000 incidents since 9/11 of harassment, violence, even killing.
And they wear the turban, they become targets.
Yes, they're uniquely vulnerable because uniquely visible. And it is dismaying beyond belief. And I'm wondering, Gideon, how this looks to you over there? All my newspaper, My Valley News, up here on Wednesday had all three of these things. It had Lochner in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
It had Aurora. It had the massacre in Wisconsin. That was the front page.
Are serial mass murders, Gideon, in this country? How do they look to you?
Well, I mean, you're right. They always get picked up in Europe, and there is general bafflement about America's reluctance or inability to enact tighter gun controls. It's seen as one of the most characteristic and least attractive features of American life, these loose gun control laws and massacres. But one should be careful because, of course, it's not unknown in Europe. There was a massacre last year in Norway by a white supremacist killing scores of children, at a socialist youth camp. So it's not like it would be impossible that it could happen here. I think there's a slight difference in reaction here in that when something like that happens, one of the first things people say is, well, let's try and control access to guns, which is obviously much harder in America. But there are parallels as well. We're not on different universes on this.
Well, our hearts go out with respect and sympathy to the Sikh community this week and their loss there. Bruce in Berlin, Connecticut. Bruce, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just calling on the marvelous landing of the Curiosity vehicle on Mars.
Wasn't that something?
Carried off with such perfection and it reminded me of a lot of watching. I can remember hearing the live telecasts of the moon landing
mm-hmm.
in 1969. Mm-hmm. I remember that very vividly, and this kind of brought it back to me.
Boy, it sure did. And the sound, the sheer sound of exhilaration and joy in that control room when they pulled it off, threaded that needle. Thanks for that, Bruce. I've got a little tape here from Adam Stelzner. This is the NASA entry, descent, and landing engineer who worked on the Mars rover, Curiosity. He was talking to Fox News on Monday about why it's important, he said, for Americans to conduct a mission to Mars.
Exploration is a fundamentally human thing, and more importantly, it's a fundamentally American thing. And that's $7 for every man, woman, and child. It's the price of a movie. And it's a movie I think the American people want to see.
Laura Meckler in Washington, we saw it this week. It was big. It was very impressive. And we'll have now months or years of images and insight from this landing craft. But where is this on the arc of American space exploration? We've heard so much about cutbacks.
Right. And this is actually a bright moment for NASA, which has had a tough time figuring out exactly what its mission is going to be in the post-space shuttle era. You know, there isn't a lot of money. There isn't. Space exploration is not a big priority at a time when we're, talking about, cutting Medicare spending and Social Security benefits. So it's tough for NASA, and they're having to try to figure out how can they do more and still continue to find, probe the universe with less money. And I think that's one of the reasons that this is just such a bright, shining moment for them. But they're still, after this is over, going to have to figure out, what's next. It isn't obvious.
We've got to bring it back to Earth again. Still big fighting this week in Syria. The prime minister there fled to Jordan. Another hit for the Assad government. Big fighting around the biggest city, Aleppo. Syrian rebels there. Well, we've got tape of them. This is an unnamed Syrian rebel talking with Reuters saying, the Central Forces will not enter here. I don't think it's going so well for them, but you can hear the determination anyway.
The Syrian army forces have not moved one step towards Aleppo, and they will not enter it. We are staying here until our last soldier.
They will not enter it. I'm not so sure it's going to turn out that way or is turning out that way, Gideon. But what do you see unfolding in the country and in the region, Gideon? There's talk of this, war from, Iran to the Mediterranean, Pakistan to the Mediterranean. What's unfolding?
Well, within Syria itself, it's clear that, as you say, the Syrian army of Assad is not a spent force. It might win some battles, but I think it's pretty clearly losing the war. Once you have the defection of the prime minister, defection of important army units, bombs going off, killing key members of the administration, it's rocky. Whether it takes weeks, months, or even another year, I don't think President Assad's has a future as the leader of that country. The question is then what happens next? Does Syria disintegrate, or is it able to move to, as Libya has, as Egypt has, to some sort of form of stable administration? I mean, stable in the sense that it actually controls the country, even if there's a degree of social and political turmoil. If Syria disintegrates, if there's a civil war, then there are numbers of dangers. There's obviously the threat that it becomes a bit like Lebanon with a sort of semi-permanent conflict, but also with the neighbors drawn in. And Syria is in a obviously a very volatile neighborhood. Israel is a neighbor. Turkey is a neighbor. Iran is a close by and a backer of the Assad regime. So the ultimate nightmare for people who are trying to keep the lid on the violence is that it becomes a proxy war between the big powers of the region, or even that they actually at some point get drawn in directly.
Laura, let's stretch the foreign policy perspective here all the way from Syria to Afghanistan. I wonder how the White House, the Obama White House, is looking at all this. You've got this tumult in Syria. In Afghanistan, just today we're hearing about three more American troops killed by Afghans in uniform, Afghan police recruits there, I guess. This has become a repeated pattern here now of, you know, they're training or they're with these troops and they turn on the Americans. What's the White House doing?
Well, I think that broadly speaking, I don't know specifically about this particular incident today, but broadly speaking, I think this is why you hear the president talking about wanting to get out of Afghanistan and draw down our troops over the next couple of years. I think that there's a conclusion that's been reached that, you know, this is not, we're not going to, you know, win this war in the traditional sense. We need to just try to leave it in a decent shape and get out. So I think that every time you see one of these incidents like that, it just adds fuel to that line of reasoning. Over in Syria, this has been, you know, a difficult thing for the White House to balance all along. You know, the administration has not been willing to get directly involved in the military conflict, despite calls from some like John McCain to arm the rebels. The White House has not been willing to go that far. Obviously, they've been trying to work it diplomatically without a lot of success, unable to convince Russia to go along with any sort of UN Security Council action to try to put pressure on the Assad regime. I think at this point, they're hoping that the rebel advances are real and that the defections that we've seen from the Syrian government are a sign that the regime is crumbling. They say that they think they are. I think that they really hope they are.
Jack, tough time to be a U.S. trooper in Afghanistan when your erstwhile Afghan allies are turning their guns on you and gunning you down.
24 of these attacks since January, 28 people killed. This was a dinner at which the police commander, turned open fire on our soldiers. You know, today, this morning on Morning Joe, Joe Scarborough's a Republican, Ed Rendell's a Democrat, former governor of Pennsylvania, and they both said it. They said, why are they over there? They're over there, and the phrase they used was CYA. They're over there to cover for Obama and for other politicians who've called for this escalation. And what are they accomplishing? And both men said, this should be what the campaign is about. The unwisdom, or whether it was wise or not, of the president's escalation there and his commitment of forces to this disaster in Afghanistan.
I want to bring it down while we have time to the human level and the Olympics. There was the great moment this week when Oscar Pistorius, this was the 25-year-old South African runner who was born without tibia bones and runs on carbon fiber prosthetics, came in last in the semifinal 400-meter race in London. Grenada's Kirani James came in first. But just listen to this whole scene.
The applause still rains down on Oscar Pistorius. No one thought he would even advance out of the first round. And look, Kirani James trading name tags with him. This is how much it means to many of these Olympic athletes. James wants to exchange with Oscar Pistorius. That in itself is a moment to remember.
Gideon Rockman in London, so many memorable moments in these games at this point. How's London feeling about its great hosting?
I think they're really enjoying it. I think there's beginning to be, like at the end of a great party, a slight dread that it's all going to be over soon. The last day of athletics is tomorrow, then the closing ceremony on Sunday. And it has been a huge lift for the city. You know, the economy is pretty flat and people aren't feeling great at the moment. And there was also a lot of anxiety about whether the Olympics would go off well. All the pre-Olympic stories seemed to be negative, something that Romney notoriously picked up on. But he was actually reflecting anxieties that were here in Britain as well. So there's been initially a huge relief that, gosh, the trains actually did run on time, the stadium worked, and so on. And then just enormous enjoyment, both at the spectacle, some of it quite parochial at the success of the British team, but also at the kind of internationalism of the event. I mean, as somebody who lives here, it's been great. You travel around and there's people from all over the world on the tube heading in different directions, so that, you know, you'll see some people heading off for the equestrian events in one part of town, other people going to the tennis at Wimbledon, other people going to the athletics. And you all sort of cross each other's paths on the tube and people chat to each other about what they've seen. Even the weather's not been too bad. Yep. So generally, it's been a good spectacle.
I have to say, I think you deserve far more than relief at this point in the games. It's been a great event, just great to watch. I mean, Laura, do you manage to catch it when you're on the campaign trail?
Not on the campaign trail, but I have caught some of it at home. And it has been remarkable, although, you know, the way that NBC has scheduled this, you know, you have to wait till 11:30 at night on the East Coast to see the best of the best of that day's competition, which I have to say is a little tiring for those of us who have to get up in the morning.
That's a little late. But Jack, I mean, up against all this other news, give me a few more Mars landings and great to human accomplishment, even in just athletics. I'll take it.
Absolutely. And here's to Hope Solo, wonderfully named goalie for the American women's soccer team, who pulled them through yesterday against Japan.
Yes, we don't want to be too nationalistic, and yet we do count those. We just can't help it.
Neither
I guess
can we.
No matter what, nobody can. This has been terrific. Gideon Rockman with the Financial Times in London, chief foreign affairs columnist there. You're great, and great to be with us. Thank you so much, Gideon.
My pleasure.
Laura Meckler, White House correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us today, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty, many thanks to you, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.